Okay. So we are actually up to a halacha day on this. I'm not sure we've done too many halacha days because of the material that we've had, but today is halacha day, and we got a good halacha, I think, to talk about. Some, not so much, we'll see, not so much applicable here, but has some applications elsewhere, and some of the issues that come up also has significant applications elsewhere, and that is the following idea. The Rabbeinu Bechai writes in Parak Chaf Ches Pasuk, Chaf Ches Pasuk Ches. Yeah, so in 28:8. So what does it say? V'chishiv afudaso asher alav, that the belt which we put on it, k'maseyu mimenu yeah, right? It's going to be like the will be of the same workmanship as the other things. What does that mean? Zahav techeles vargaman v'sulas shani v'sheish mashzar. So it's going to be gold, turquoise, purple, scarlet wool, and twisted linen. So scarlet wool and twisted linen. So comes the there is a comment from Rabbeinu Bechaye, which the Minchas Asher quotes in Siman Dalet, which says the following. It says v'lo matzino. It's interesting that we don't find any of the materials used in the Mishkan were made of meshi. What is meshi? Do we know what meshi is? She is silk. Nothing is made of silk. Why is nothing made of silk? So where does silk come from? Worms. So I don't really know how this works, but there's things called silkworms. Does that mean that all, like when it says 100% silk on a tie, it means, I don't know if this one is.
Yes.
Not this one. But if it's 100% silk tie, that means it's coming from worms, right? Yeah, so worms are not kosher.
To eat.
Right. Right, that's what you mean.
That's what
kosher
says.
But now wearing,
I mean,
I don't even do it wearing.
They're not aser bahana, but yes, they are aser to eat. So he says that we don't find silk used in the Mishkan. Why? Vishu yotzi miguf hasheretz shehu telas, because it comes from a sheretz, so the worm, v'lo hukshar l'melechas ha-mishkan el adavar tahar. And the only things that we permit for use in the Mishkan are things that are tahor. Similarly to the question that was raised with regards to the, which animal?
Honeybee.
The, no, not, that's a different topic, but yeah, it's in here as well. The tachash. What is the tachash? Who knows? We don't know what the tachash is. Right? Rabbi Slifkin has about 15 possibilities in his chapter in Perek Aleph of Sacred Monsters. But the Gemara itself has a question about what the tachash is and suggests, well, it's got to be a kosher animal, because how could you have something that's a non-kosher animal be used for the Mishkan? So your response is, who says? Maybe not. Vas.
Is that the one that split the stone?
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No.
Lachash?
No, the tachash.
Tachash, yeah.
The tachash didn't split the stone. The splitting of the stone was the...
Something's ear.
The what?
Something's
ear.
The...
Sephir or something?
It's escaping my mind right now. What? The tachash was some kind of... it was used for the... The skin was used for the covering of the Mishkan. Right, the multicolored top... Yeah, so whatever that was, so the Gemara questions whether it was kosher. One opinion is, well, it must have been kosher. The other opinion is, who says it was kosher? So we see, so the Rabbeinu Bechaye, however, says that, like we said, by the Tachash, right? But Seva Tolas Shani, now what about the Tolas Shani, though? What is Tolas Shani made of? So that was Techeles. What is Techeles? Techeles comes from a
snail.
So he says the Tolas Shani... That's not actually coming from the snail itself, rather it's from the
shell?
Liquid that is contained within, the secretions that are within it. So that's his suggestion. So
that's not the snail.
That's so hold on, okay. So he says, wait a second. He says, I got a problem, right? The tcheles, I think there's gum.
They didn't milk the snail, they killed the snail.
What? Right, that's what I thought. That's what he says. He says, but so Rav Asher, why he says, V'yishlith mo, l'choral divir Rabbeinu B'chai, da'lu tzeva techeles hai b'mikdash, gam b'yirius, v'gam b'vigdi ha'kahuna. Right, it was used for all the different things. So, o the chilazun, sheretz tamehu, ve'enu min hamutter, v'ficha, umay shnami meshi. Why should it be different than meshi? V'al korachach b'uchum yizad, v'yis ha'mikdash lo tzarech klal min hamutter b'ficha, v'yim kein gam meshi kashabo. He says, it seems like from the fact that the chilazun was used, the chilazun should be permissible. And what's he talking about, that the meshi was not usable? So the Shamir. The Shamir was the, yeah. So it's another chapter in Sacred Monsters, right? The impressive Shamir, yeah. So Dr. Ibrahim has done research into what the Shamir was. So anyways, they argue with regards to the Rishon that in fact argue about the source of it itself. Because the source is a Gemara Maseches Brachos. The Gemara Brachos, their comments, L'chukshru l'melech ha-shamayim el or behemet Torah b'lvad. That the only things that are mutter from Lech HaShemayim are things that come from an or behema tahora, things that come from a kosher skin, right? V'dachu, and they ask the following question. Hold on a second, let me just... Oh, okay. So the Gemara in Shabbos has that question. We can only use things that are from kosher animals. So they answer, so no. What does that line mean, where it says we can only use things for avodas Hashem that are from the behemoth tahor? That's actually talking only about the tefillin. But not necessarily things in the Beis HaMikdash. Things in the Beis HaMikdash perhaps could have been used. It's only a specific halacha by tefillin. So that's the machlokas that takes place in Masechta Shabbos, at least that the Rishonim have, when the Gemara makes this line that the only things you use for avodas kosher are things that are kosher. It could be that it's not referring to all things. Really, that's just a specific halacha with regards to tefillin, and perhaps that then spells itself out in that comment of Rabbeinu Bechai, that you weren't allowed to use silk because those are things that are not kosher, but there are those that perhaps would disagree. Now, he goes on to say that he says the truth is that even according to Rabbeinu Bechaye, you could answer the question of the chilazon, you could answer the question of the dying from the following idea. I mean, even if you want to say that, oh, Taka, that's interesting, that there is no silk used in the entire Mishkan/Beis HaMikdash because it's not kosher. So how do we allow the use of chilazon? So he says there's a big difference, right? The chilazon is a dye, right? The silk is a material. Right, so he says that perhaps the prohibition is using the material of something that's not kosher, but just to use something that's not kosher towards a dye, he says that's permissible. Right, the shiny tchelis to have a chazusa biyama, that tchelis is just the way it looks. Right, if chazusa, that we're not going to be makbid on. Similarly, and this part is the part I want to say was interesting. For here, similarly, and the Nudvi Hud has made this point as well. Amnam, he says, B'chayel Shu is Dvar Shmuel, raised the following thing. Can you do the following? Dun imutter lasus diyo mistam yenam vihitir mikamatamim. Can you use diyo? What is diyo? Diyo is ink. So can you use ink that is made from stam yenam? What is stam yenam?
Wine.
That's yenam. What's stam yenam? What is stam yenam referring to? Stam yenam is the terminology used for wine that was touched by a non-Jew, or wine that was under the control of the non-Jew, which we don't know whether it was used for avodah zarah. Meaning, the prohibition of the Torah is what we call yayin nesach are things that is wine that was actually used for the purpose of avodah zarah. That's for sure is prohibited banah, etc. And then the rabban came along and said, not only are things that are yayin nesach going to be prohibited, but even wine that was under the control of non-Jews is also going to be prohibited, even if we don't know what their intentions were or what they did with it, etc. And that's what's called stam yenam. So can you use stam yenam? You can't drink stam yenam. Can you get benefit from? It's a little vague as to what the status is of that bisman. Is that we try to be machmir, but b'di'evit it's mutter. So lemaisa, if someone gives you a bottle of wine that's not kosher, you are allowed to give it away. Meaning, l'chachila we're machmir, don't go and buy bottles of wine that are not kosher in order to give them out as gifts. But if it's already in your possession, meaning somebody comes to your house and gives you a bottle of wine that's not kosher, so you're allowed to go ahead and re-gift it. That's the way that we paskin meyakar adin. Vas?
If you own a wine store, you can sell.
If you own a wine store, well, a wine store is a problem. It's a good question. I don't know what the... There is an issue of just being involved in the sale of non-kosher food. I mean, however, I believe that prohibition is only things that are Isuri Doraisa. It's been a while since we've looked into this. This is a big issue. In Phoenix, somebody came to me. They wanted to open a grocery store that was going to sell non-kosher meat. So that's an issue. You're not allowed to be involved in the sale of non-kosher meat. Now, I believe that we've worked out a contract as to how it would be okay. But I believe that the issue is only non-kosher meat, things that are really prohibited. What? Right, so stan yin, we assume, is only yisid derabanan, so I think it would then be mutter, I think, but I'm not prepared right now to pasken that shayla. So before you start opening your wine, before you get your Pennsylvania state liquor license, which are so, not so easy to come by, we could discuss further. All right.
Sorry, regifting to Jews is not appropriate.
Oh, that would be not appropriate because that's what we call lifnei iver.
So when would you regift to a non-Jew?
So I know you're a halakha guy, but there are some people that go to work. You know, everybody here is learning in Kollel, Yovam v'Laila, but there are those that go to work and some even have non-Jewish colleagues. I've heard of such things. And even if you don't, I've heard that there are some people that have, like, you know, cleaning professionals that come to their homes who they like giving extra food to, particularly in the days leading up to Pesach. So, yeah. Yeah?
If you give you non-kosher wine, and you know that your Jewish neighbor has workers in his factory that he could give it away to, would you be able to give it to him to say this?
Yeah, I mean, that's not an issue. It's not a subject, well...
You're giving it to a Jew.
That's a good question. So from your perspective, there's two issues. Number one is that there's something called lifnei iver. So lifnei iver is if there's a concern that the other person's going to violate the prohibition. So there's no concern here that he's going to violate a prohibition. So therefore, from your side, it's okay. However, from his side, it's a little more problematic. Why is he accepting it in the first place? Right, so he might have an issue of accepting it, right? But I'm not sure. I gotta. That's off topic.
Then that Jew would be a shaliach to give it to a non-Jew. The Jew you gave it to would be a shaliach to give it to a non-Jew.
Right, but I'm saying if he's getting benefit. I mean, if by you giving it to the Jew, so you're. He's entering into an agreement where he's going to now be benefiting l'chachila, you know, from the starting point of benefiting from the stuff. Now, so is there an issue for him to enter that agreement? For you, I don't think, for the person who has the wine in their hand, it's probably not an issue. And there's a question if he's allowed, maybe he shouldn't take it from you, he shouldn't get involved in such a transaction. And then if he's not supposed to get involved in such a transaction, so then that bounces back to the original guy saying, well, he's not allowed to give it to him then, right? Anyways, so Rav Asher Weiss here is suggesting that there's a difference. There's a difference between using the material of silk versus using ink, versus using a dye. Dye is not the material. Dye just goes on the material, and therefore dye could even be from non-kosher animals. Now, he raises this issue from the Dvar Shmuel that he was asked about whether it's permissible to use ink that comes from stan yin. I mean, he permitted it. Why did he permit it? Well, those are a different topic. I don't know. I don't see the Dvar Shmuel. All I see is the quote from it. But one of the things that he does not say is the ein kan ela chazusa kasher. He never says, oh, it's only mutter because it's just something that you're looking at. It's only something that you're seeing. It's not something that you're actually using. So he doesn't say that. It should imply what? Imply that perhaps that's not such a great leniency. So he says, however, what was he asked about? What was the Dvar Shmuel asked about? The Dvar Shmuel was specifically asked about the ink for the tefillin. The ink, it sounds like, for the tefillin itself, for the writing of the tefillin. The writing of the tefillin, perhaps you would say, is more than just a dye, right? A dye is something that you just dip in and you dye, right? The writing on tefillin is perhaps the mitzvah itself. That perhaps is the object, right? You don't have much without the ink on the tefillin itself. So perhaps that would be a distinction that you can make. That within the letters itself, that would be a problem. So there is a very beautiful story that Rabbi Riskin has in his book, where he tells when he was the rabbi in Lincoln Square Synagogue, he says that apparently he used to go every Sunday, every Friday, I think, to go visit with Rav Moshe Feinstein. So, anyway, so some interesting stuff here. He has a couple of interesting discussions that he had with him, but he has what he calls a postscript where he talks about the love that Rav Moshe had for the Jewish people. And he tells the story that one of his students in JSS, when you go to Yeshiva University, there's four, four or five Jewish studies programs, right? YU has a dual curriculum, so you got to have be in Yeshiva College or Sisim School of Business in the afternoon, and you have to be in a Judaic studies program in the morning. So one of those, so the guys in the yeshiva that go as the yeshiva, so that they're in what's called the Mezir Yeshiva program, which means that you're learning all morning. But they have two other programs that people take classes, like college classes for credit, and those are counting as for the Judaic studies program. So one of those is called JSS, the James Dreyer School, and that is traditionally for Bali Tshuva, traditionally for people that are coming in for YU without much of a background. So Rabbi Riskin taught in JSS, and he had a student who apparently went on to become a prominent sofer and a sofer and a prominent member of the Satmar community. That's quite a leap. I don't know how you get from one to the other. Yes, that was what he said. So anyway, so he used to come and he used to visit with Rabbi Riskin regularly. And one day he shows up with clippings from article from journals and encyclopedias telling him that he has done the following research, which came up with that the resin that is used to blacken the tefillin straps and the batim, come from the bark of a tree that's indigenous to Israel, which Shmuel Salant said was okay. But he showed that the resin is not actually coming from the bark, but rather coming from worms that inhibit the bark of the tree. So the ink is coming, right? The resin that is being used for this ink is coming from this bark. And worms that are living, crawling, and impure, and therefore are non-kosher creatures. Now, he says here, every part of the tefillin is supposed to be from a kosher animal. So he says, the first thing I did was I got a new pair of tefillin with ink that is made from vegetable source, the resin, right, which costed $900. But, you know, that was the first thing I did. The second thing I did was go to Rav Moshe and ask Rav Moshe Feinstein what he thought about this. He says, you know, the question is, do I have to tell my members of my shul? Do I have to tell the whole world that, oh, we have to stop using this? So he said that every time, whenever he would bring Rav Moshe a shaila, so Rav Moshe would answer it right away. Or he would say, excuse me, and get up and look up a Gemara or look up something and sit down and answer the questions, and difficult questions. And I said, this time Rav Moshe told him to come back next week. And he says, when he came back next week, he could see that Rav Moshe was pacing back and forth. And the Rebbetzin opens the door and says to him, you certainly worried my husband. He's pretty much been pacing back and forth for the entire last week. And he said, as soon as Rav Moshe saw him, he stopped pacing. His entire manner expressed a resolute decision. I'm glad you brought this matter to my attention, he said. I don't want you to say anything further about it or to do anything further about it. We dare not invalidate the tefillin of the entire Jewish people for the last hundreds of years. We do not bring disrepute upon Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the one who said that you should use those trees. Our parents and grandparents have prayed with kosher tefillin. God would never have allowed them to do otherwise. Mir tur nit paselin di tefillin fun klal Yisrael. Right? We're not going to invalidate the tefillin of the entire Jewish people. Oh, wow. End of the story.
Is Rabbi Riskin?
Rabbi Riskin is telling the story of his meeting with Rav Moshe.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. So what's the teretz? Mm. Right? So on one hand, so one teretz, so perhaps... What's the terror? So it sounds like it just can't be. It's got to be.
If you do something wrong for such a long time, it already becomes accepted.
Right. So, no. That's not what he's saying. I think what Rav Moshe is really saying is that there must be a teretz. There must be an answer. I'm not necessarily sure what it is, but to go around and say something that is now going to passel all the tefillin of Klal Yisrael, it can't be that there's a problem. There must be an answer. So don't say anything about it, and we'll find an answer. We'll find an answer. So I'll tell you, there's another story, not really a story. There was I'll finish this part and then tell the other story. So perhaps part of the answer might be this. What?
But people would from that time forward, wasn't there any suggestion from that time forward?
He said no, because we don't want to apostle anyone in the past, right? Just don't say anything about it. Now he published it in a book, but the statute of limitations has already run out. But that was the din. That was the psalm. I don't know what we do bisman is. I don't know. I probably have some sofrim that I now know due to my current business that I could probably ask. But anyways, this is what's written in the sefer here. So perhaps based on what we learned here, perhaps there's a teretz. Luli mistafina. I'm a little nervous to go. I'm sure Moshe in his week of pacing probably thought of this. But according to what we just said, perhaps there's a difference between the dye used for the writing versus the ink used for the writing versus the dye, the resin used for the painting. Right, painting, even though, yes, there is a din that the tefillin have to be painted black, that's still considered a dye. As opposed to the writing is considered writing. So the writing is really the ikar mitzvah. And whatever we use in terms of the painting, that's considered a dye. And perhaps the requirement that it be a kosher animal perhaps doesn't apply to that. Now, yes, it's true. That Gemara in Shabbos that we mentioned before about the tachash kosher, is it not kosher? He said, well, how could it be that something used in the base of Migdash is for something not kosher? And he said, well, maybe it could be, whatever. But how can you say, what is that line that everything has to be kosher? That's applicable to tefillin. That's our case we're talking about. So tefillin, everybody agrees that that has to be from a kosher animal. But once again, maybe that's only talking about the batim, it's talking about the straps, maybe it's not talking about the paint. Maybe the paint, such a thing would be okay. Perhaps there's a further reason that we would say it's okay. We'll get to that shortly. What? He said, this was an issue with the resin used for, that's why I checked the story here. It was an issue used for the resin used to paint the batim and the straps, not necessarily, but he doesn't say that it was used for the actual ksav itself, for the ink itself. So maybe the ink itself is from a different...
Bought boxes of sand and it was a whole
art. Yeah. Now I'll tell one other story along these lines, and that is when I when I first moved here, a couple months after we moved here, we had someone from out of town and he got an aliyah. And after davening, he didn't do it during davening, but I had an aliyah after him, something like that. See, he pointed out to me that he looked at the letters, and the letters were all missing what's called the kotzu shel yud. What's the kotzu shel yud? Anybody know?
The top.
Kotzu shel yud, there's a tiny, right, if you look at the, if you look at a yud, so there's a tiny, according to what it says in the Mishnah Berurah, right, there's a tiny little leg that's supposed to be coming up. I forget if it's the top or the bottom. Of the edge of the yud right now. I think the bottom, actually.
Really?
I think the kosher yud is the bottom of the, when you have the top part of the
little tail.
The little tail that comes out of the bottom. That's called the kotzel shel yud. There, in fact, is a, and that is, in fact, ma'akiv b'di'evit. That is required, it seems, from learning Shulchan Aruch. And if you, there was a famous poem that was written by the Maskilim in the 1800s, I forget who wrote it. I don't think it was Bialik wrote this one. I forget. It was maybe Bialik did write it. I don't remember. One of them wrote this poem entitled Kotzel Shel Yud, which is that some guy wrote a get to his wife and ran away, or he wasn't giving a get to his wife, and then finally he did write it, and he ran away, and finally she has her get. And then one of the Rabbanim look at it, and they see that the little leg of the yud, is the kotzel shel yud, is missing. So now he passels the entire get, and this girl's forced to remain the rest of her life as an aguna. So one could see what they're trying to get at with such a thing. Now I'm not an expert in Hilchos Gittin, but I have a few. Well, number one is I'm not sure the kotzel shel yud is ma'akiv in Gittin, and second of all, bizman hazeh, the girl doesn't actually keep the get. Nowadays, and I assume this existed then as well, the practice is that the man gives the wife a get, and then in front of Basin acknowledges it, takes the get away, rips it up, puts it in the garbage, and never sees it again, and they write her a receipt that you got a get under these in front of us, and that's what she holds on to for the rest of her life. So why do they do that? Because we don't want to have one of these situations where somebody takes a look and says, look at that, a puzzle get, right? And then everything's messed up, right? So anyways, but that was that poem. So you see, kotzel shel yud is important. So a so
I'm pretty sure it's the top, right?
You think it's the top? I have not.
I don't
remember right now. You might be. You could very well be right. I don't remember. So what was I going to say? So this guy called me up and said, looked at, showed me the Sefer Torah. He says, there's no kotzel shel yud. And I looked, I said, okay, that's an issue. Then I looked up two lines, and there's another yud, and there was no kosher yud. I looked up another two lines, there's no kosher yud. Like, whatever. I'm not going to, obviously it was written on purpose this way, right? If it's one that's missing, so then you got a problem. But if you see all the yuds are written a particular way, I said, I don't know the halacha, but I can, so I called somebody up after Shabbos, and they said, yeah, that Rav Moshe has a tshuva on the topic, and all the he matters it, and all the yuds from mostly from Russian Sefer Torah. The first thing the guy said to me was it a very heavy Sefer Torah? Which those that have been Beth Medrash know that pretty much all of our Sefer Torah are very heavy Sefer Torah. I said, yeah, so it's probably Russian, and there the minhag was not to use it. So okay, so I tracked down the tshuva of Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe says the same thing, that if the minhag of a place is to the Masorah specifically developed in this particular way, he said that's the Masorah. And even though it seems like it goes against Shulchan Aruch, we're not going to go ahead and pasul Sifri Torah because they're missing the Vinyan Nekuda. Now nowadays, I don't believe any Sifri Torah are written that way anymore. Now Sifri Torah are written more uniformly, but entire area of the world had Sifri Torah written that way. We're not going to go ahead and pasul it. So that reminded me of this story. So, anyways, he has by just plus it's a great ending. He has three more paragraphs here. He says on one of those Friday mornings, after having their discussion, Rav Moshe said to him, would you mind coming with me to yeshiva? I need a minion. I need a minion. So maybe, I'm not sure there's going to be enough guys. Can you come with me? So he said, fine. So Rav Moshe walks over to the bookshelf. He takes off a paper bag, picks up a paper bag, which he put in a little bottle of whiskey and some honey cake and some plates and spoons, and they walk off to yeshiva. So he gets there at noon, and there are seven boys that were leaving yeshiva. So Rav Moshe says, no, so one, two, seven, can you find one more? So one guy goes in, they get another in, now they have 10 boys. So Rav Moshe read the last line of a Masechta. I'm not sure which, he doesn't say which Masechta, but he took out a Gemara. I say, I want to make a siyum to complete a Masechta in the Gemara. Okay. So Moshe takes time. So he reads the last line, says the Hadron, says Kaddish. And so he says, no, everybody, Sudas Mitzvah, everybody has some cake and some schnapps. So Rabbi Riskin says, I can't believe that I would never have the guts to do this. Rabbi Riskin says, he asked him, so I said, why are you so excited? So he says, well, so I just finished Roll of Shas. So I'm making a siyum of Shas, and I figured it would be a special occasion. It's not just a Masech, it's all a Shas, so everybody can have some cake and schnapps. So Rabbi Riskin said, so is this the first time you finished all of Shas? He said, no, this was the 100th time. 100? He says, the next morning I began to learn Daf Yomi. that's what he said, this is the 100th time. So the amazing part to me is that he finished Shas 100 times. Yeah, the amazing thing is that, yes, I finished 100 times, so I'll gather eight guys around, see who's around, and we'll have a see him on some honey cake.
What year, doesn't say.
When did he finish 100 times? What year was that?
It doesn't say, but he says, I risk it, this is in the 70s probably, if I had to guess.
In the early 90s.
Rav Moshe died in 85, I believe, 85 or 86, I forget. What? Rav Moshe was your rabbi.
No, he wasn't my rabbi. No, I lived on the Lower East Side where he lived. That's the only thing.
Right.
No, my brother went to NPJ, he was a Russian Shiva.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. No, he wasn't my rabbi. But I used to swarm with him.
Okay, so one more issue to discuss along these lines, and that is that there is a Rambam. The Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Kli HaMikdash, he has a section called Hilchos Kli HaMikdash Va'udimbo. The vessels of the Mikdash and those that serve it. So it's interesting, the Rav has a whole word about how the Kohen Gadol was actually the furniture of the Beis HaMikdash. Maybe we'll get to that a little bit later. But he has a line here, Hamor, that there's this thing required that's more. What is more? More. Mem Vav Resh. What is more? So the Rambam says, I'll tell you what it is. Hamor hu hadam hatsara b'chaya shebehodu. It is the blood that comes from a animal from Hodu. What's Hodu? India. Some kind of animal that comes from India, hayadu l'chol, shemisbaspim bo b'nei adam b'chol makam, because people use it to smell in all these different places. So that's what more is. It comes from this chaya in India. So the Ravid says, what are you talking about? How could that be? Right? Shenitzu b'maisa hektish dam shum chaya ba'ola, kol shik ba'olam. That, first of all, he says, we don't use blood for anything in the entire world. The more, by the way, is used for for the Ketores, I believe. So he says that, what are you talking about? He said, how could that be? Blood, we don't use blood from any chaya for anything in the base of Midrash. There's no deer korban, right? And second of all, kol shekein dam chaya tameya, certainly if it's a non-kosher animal. Right? He says, rather, what's more? More rather is myrrh, M-Y-H-R-R, this spice that is used. That's really what it's talking about. It's not talking about more in the blood from this animal. So the Kesef Mishnah suggests that says no, it's not. It's okay because even though it might be the blood from this animal, the blood is left out to dry and it just becomes a powder. That damor nishtana midam b'havi ka'afar ba'alma becomes afar ba'alma, and therefore it should be. And that's why it's able to be usable. It's not really considered the original thing that it, you know, that it once was. Not really considered blood. Now this opens a large amount of questions. That's the whole gelatin shaila, right? Gelatin. Non-kosher, what's called non-kosher gelatin, right? It comes from, how do you make gelatin? You use fish, you use bones. You grind up the bones into a powder, and that's how they make the gelatin. So for, you know, when I was growing up, you know, you can get gummy bears. I mean, you know, jelly beans were one thing, but gummy bears, you couldn't get into those kinds of things. And now all of these things became mutter. Why are all these things become mutter? Because somebody developed, I believe, it's Mr. Holzer, the guy who put together those books, The Rav Speaks, that we use from sometimes. So he developed a fish gelatin that they use. They use fish gelatin instead of animal gelatin, so therefore it's under hasher. But you may hear people say, oh, gelatin's mutter, gelatin's really kosher. So there were tshuvas written the first part of the 20th century that said it was okay, that if you grind up the stuff to a point that it's a powder and it's irrecognizable, so it should be mutter. So, you know, the major kashrus agencies paskin not that way, so therefore we assume that it's not kosher. But we, now that there's a kosher gelatin on the market, so really the whole question has kind of gone to has fallen by the wayside. But anyways, that falls into this as well. This is part of this Rambam, that this stuff that was used in the base of Migdash, yes, it's true that it was that it might have been from a non-kosher animal, but it's irrecognizably being from a non-kosher animal, and therefore it's okay. So Rav Asher Weiss goes on, has some more details about it, but maybe we'll stop here. Yeah. And therefore, it's kosher or not kosher?
It's not kosher.
Right, so we assume these
but
things.
I mean,
right, so we've paskin not that way. I mean, yeah, one can make a case that it would be mutter, but the national kosher agencies have rejected it.
Yeah.
So when people say, you know, they might have a candy under a not so reputable hechsher, that might be one of the issues that are out there. Oh, what do you mean? It's a rabbi saying it's okay. Well, it could be that that's, you know, not necessarily the same standards. All right, have a good day.
You already discussed the sharpness aspect.